Thank you very much. I hope this is going to work. If I forget to change the slides, tell me. So, if we can have the first slide, thank you. So, kind of what happened really, I guess it's happened twice now. It happened when email was invented, whatever it was, about 15 years ago. And it really happened again when Facebook was created, 8 or so years ago now. There was a kind of promise by the techies that this was going to open up a new social vista for you. You're going to be part of the technology was going to make you part of the global village, and you were going to have friendships all over the world, and the number of friends you were going to have was going to be limited only by the size of the human population today. And the question is what was written on the tin, is the promissory note that was written on the tin actually true? Has that actually happened? And I'm going to tell you no, and try and explain why. So if I can have the next one. These are Facebook's own data, so you have to believe them. So in the aftermath of all this discussion as to whether there really was a limit or not on the number of friends you can have, they actually analyzed their entire database, all 400 million Facebook users, as far as I understand, anyway. And it turned out that the average number of users is actually about 150. That's what they actually say on their own website now. The distribution is a little bit skewed, so the modal value is actually about 120 to 130, which in my view is about where it should be, because remember, Granny isn't online on the whole. So there's a sort of set of family that you don't include in your Facebook page that you need to make an allowance for. So about 120 online friends is about where it should be. But the mode is off to the left, if you like, the most common value to the left of or a little lower than the average, simply because there's a very long tail to the right. So it really is true that some people have very large numbers of people signed up as friends on Facebook. Facebook will let you have up to 5,000 names. The people who are in the far right of that tail are really professional users, predominantly. They're people like journalists using it as information sources, contacts for information, or they're people like writers or bands or, as I discovered a few weeks ago, Cadbury's, who have Facebook pages for their individual products, and interactive ones too, you know, conversations with people on Facebook about the current size and shape of whatever it is, chocolate bars or a particular chocolate bar and so on. So there are those professional users which are really pushing it right out to the end. They don't really count. There is a group in the middle who are sort of have numbers somewhere between, let's say, 200. So the sort of natural range of variation around the norm, as it were, is somewhere between 100 and 200 friends, probably. So the people who have more than 200 friends outwards are probably going out to about 500 or so, but not a lot beyond that. There are two possible explanations for this group. One is they're just including acquaintances rather than true friends, but Facebook muddies the water by calling them all friends. So they're actually not doing anything that's different to normal. There is a second group, and they're the ones who are in a competition to see who can have the most friends. And we think most of those are blokes. And it's a kind of form of mating strategy, right? Because blokes have discovered that if you're very popular, the girls get attracted to you. But I can't quite figure out that actually it's not just signing people up as friends that's important. It's actually being popular. They don't make that discrimination, so they sign lots and lots of friends up. So these are the sort of older teenagers, boys, as it were. The other interesting, or perhaps important thing in terms of how people handle Facebook is really what these data are. These data are, again, from Facebook. So Cameron Marlowe here is one of Facebook's sociologists. He does a lot of analyses for them of their entire data set. And what he got interested in the context, again, of this same discussion, is really how did having large numbers of friends signed up on Facebook really make a difference to your sort of social extension, as it were. So what is plotted here is people who have only about 50 friends signed up, people who have about 150 friends, and then people who have more than 500 friends signed up. And it's just used three different definitions of close friendship. So this is what he's trying to pick out from the traffic that goes on, the actual postings and the conversations that go on, how many people you're actually talking to among the 50 or the 500 friends you've got on your Facebook. How many of those you really actually engaged in conversations with most of the time? And it turns out that the pinker the girls, by the way, and the bluer the boys. So you can see girls always have slightly bigger numbers than the boys. But the key thing is that even though you've got a tenfold difference in the size of the total number of friends signed up, the actual number of core friends that most of your social time is devoted to on Facebook doesn't differ very much. It's only really going up by at most a factor of three. So there's something about the way our social worlds work, which even though we know lots and lots of people, in fact, most of our social time is concentrated on a very, very small number of people, typically something between five and 10 at the most. Okay, thanks. These are some of our own data, just making the same point. So this is looking at the number of kind of close friends you've got. We might think of them as close friends. So typically, the sort of people in the second layer of friendship. So not your intimate friends, but the friends in the further circle out of best friends, as you might say. So the people you socialize most with. And it's the same sort of group that Cameron Marlowe is pitching at here. And we're simply asking, how does the number of friends you have vary as a function of whether you're just a passive user of Facebook or whether you're a really intense active user? And the answer is not at all. These are actually Dutch students, Dutch university students. And we also asked them for the same data set to tell us for each of these individuals here in their close social network what their emotional closeness to them was on a simple analog scale, so 0 to 100. And again, you can see that the average emotional closeness to your sort of 15 best friends simply doesn't vary. Spending more time and being more sort of savvy, if you like, doesn't actually, A, give you more friends or make you more socially engaged with those that you have. And in fact, there is a tendency for emotional closeness in this sense of these relationships to be negatively related to the number of people you put in this close category. It's as though you have a limited amount of social capital, and if you have five best friends, you divide that among five, but if you have 15, you're dividing the same amount among 15, so the average closeness to each of them is much less. Okay. Here's a bit more evidence of where the problem lies. So this is a diary study that we did summer before last. And we asked a bunch of about 40 odd people to record every day all the interactions they had with essentially their five best friends. And to record for every interaction they'd had with them, how they did it. Did they do it by face-to-face interaction, by Skype, by phone, that's instant messaging, by texting or by email and social or on a social networking site. And to say for that interaction, their sense of contentedness and satisfaction with it on a simple happiness scale that psychologists have developed, as it were. And this is what's being measured here. And you can see that face-to-face and Skype are perceived as being much, much more satisfying modes of interaction with these same individuals. So they're mostly interacting with all the same individuals across these different modes of interaction, so we can actually compare across them quite reasonably. But the key to it is this big difference in laughter rates here. So this is sort of looking at simply whether or not laughter occurred. Either real laughter, which is mostly here, or virtual laughter in these ones, so the use of emoticons in text messages or emails or LOLs or little acronyms like that. I'm always tempted to point out for folks in my generation, that LOL does not mean lots of love like we used to put on the back of envelopes to our girlfriends in the 60s when we were 14. It means laugh out loud. I'm sure there was a phase when lots of older folk, parents were getting LOLs, or not parents maybe, lots of older folk were getting LOLs from younger folk thinking, oh, look, lots of love, isn't this exciting? but this kind of points to the importance of laughter in the context of relationships, and I'll come back to that. It really turns out to be fundamental. But the key question now is, what happens with these happiness ratings as a function of whether or not you get laughter in a relationship, in an interaction? And here's the big difference. So here again are your modes of interaction: face-to-face, Skype, phone, instant messaging, texting, or email and social networking site. These are the satisfaction ratings for interactions that involve laughter in some form, and these are the same interaction, the same mode of communication where the interaction didn't involve laughter in any form. You see, they're all much higher. Even, you know, just putting in an emoticon with a smiley face lifts the quality of the interaction. There's something about laughter that seems to be incredibly important. Okay. So why is this happening, and what are the actual constraints on the number of relationships we can have? Well, this all goes back to really this graph here, which is a plot of mean social group size in different species of monkeys here and apes here, plotted against the relative size of the brain. In this case, we're using the neocortex, because that's the bit that's expanded out of all proportion. So this is the classic social brain hypothesis, which says that if you want to live in a very big group, social group, you have to have a big brain to do it, so that you get these nice correlations. There are interesting differences between the apes and the monkeys, which suggests that the apes are doing something more clever, if you like, in cognitive terms, to support the same size of group compared with monkeys, but that's kind of another story. If we plug humans into this, and we have humans in the same database, so it's very nicely controlled. So next slide, please. Anything happening? Oh, here we go. Plugging humans in, and again, please. And reading them up to the 8 line. Okay. Yep, no, it's going, okay. Clunky technology. What you get if you read across from the ape regression line, because that's where we should be apes, is this figure of about 150. It's now known as Dunbar's number. And I have to say, it's really ironical that it should have been christened Dunbar's number at all, because it was actually christened so by punters on Facebook. In the course of an extended discussion, it was actually the cause of Facebook and ultimately of when Google Plus came online, of them putting these layers in so that you could limit the number of people who saw different parts of your wall, as it were. But this came off the back of a discussion on Facebook with people saying, I've signed all these people up, but I actually don't know who half of them are. And somebody had obviously read about this story here and said, oh, well, you know, there's this theory that there is a limit. So somebody christened it Dunbar's number, to whom I am eternally grateful. If I ever find them, I'll buy them a bottle of champagne. are you here? I was waiting for somebody to do that. Yeah, it was me. all right, next slide then. Okay, so here's a mixture of data just to establish the point that this number is real. So these are just casual observations of a variety of things, some historical, some contemporary. Social organization sizes, community sizes, grouping sizes, which fall within the range of variation around this value of 150, which is about 100 to 200. And then these are three different data sets, which were, if you like, as opposed to casual observations, these are sort of attempts to actually collect data to show it. I'll just comment on these two, really, because these are our analyses. These are largely hunter-gatherer and small-scale horticulturist census data size. So if you imagine a line up there, each line is one traditional society, but as you can see, the census data give a number of different grouping sizes. So these, what these actually are in reality is these are overnight camp sizes, sometimes known as bands in the hunter-gatherer literature. These are kind of regional grouping sizes out of which bands are composed. So people slot in and out of bands, but typically if they change bands, they will change band into another band which belongs to this level of grouping. These are sometimes known as regional groupings in some hunter-gatherer literatures, as clans in other hunter-gatherer literatures. These have sometimes been labeled by archaeologists as mega bands because they've picked this up, and long before we looked at these data. And this is essentially tribe size up here. It's all the people that speak the same language or same dialect in a big language group. So there's sort of quite nice data here suggesting that indeed this 150 had some reality. Here's the 150. These are the 95% confidence intervals around that 150 predicted by the Great Ape regression line. And these are this set of groupings, this type of grouping, it falls very nicely around that value and within those limits. And none of these other types of groupings do. And what's interesting about this is that it really is a virtual grouping. You don't see it on the ground. You can't see it on the ground. It exists only in the people's minds, that they know that they belong to that community. And this was our first attempt. So this is looking top down, if you like, on the population. So you're looking at how the population is distributed in space. And we thought, well, we could look at it bottom up and look at individuals and see what their social network size is. And this is an attempt to look at, if you like, contemporary societies in the industrialized world. So we had thought that Christmas card distribution lists might be the thing to look at. It's the sort of thing you have to think about. It costs money, so you know it's a serious job. And we got a bunch of people to tell us who they sent Christmas cards to, not just the number of cards they sent, but how many people there were altogether in the receiving household. And it turns out the mean is, whatever it is, it's almost exactly 150. There's a lot of variation around this. There are some folk that are terribly mean, and some folk that are terribly generous. They send Christmas cards to their dentists and lawyers and bakers and all this kind of stuff. But you know, you've got this nice peak that sits rather comfortably around the point of 150. Okay. And this is my favorite example. This is absolute proof of Dunbar's number, if ever there was. Right? Has anybody seen this one before? Yes, okay. So you know the story. So this girl had all her friends tattooed, pictures of all her friends tattooed onto her arm. And she had 152 of them. Right? Wonderful evidence that this thing exists, the casual example. One has to say, this is an incredibly stupid thing to do. Right? Because as I'll show you in a minute, this is not a matter of, you're going to be happy with this in about a year or two's time, because the turnover on friendships in particular is quite high at almost any age group. It's very funny. And I've talked to sort of teenagers, sort of 16, 17-year-olds, and I said, you know, about a third of your friends now won't be your friends in 2 years' time. Oh, yes, they will. They're my best friends. You don't understand. Friendships decay very fast. They will turn over. They just have no conception that the people that who are their best friends now will not necessarily be their best friends in a few years' time. Anyway, you know, had she really done this, it would be like, you know, sailors' tattoos of the old days. I love Susie, tattooed on here around her heart. You'd be saddled with people that in about 5 years' time you probably hated. So fortunately, it turns out, next please, that this was a hoax. It was a publicity stunt by the tattoo artist. But it was a YouTube thing. You can go and see her doing it on YouTube, or apparently doing it on YouTube. But what you don't see is actually the critical thing. These are actually transfers. And paradoxically, and I think this is the one, the lovely example, the human arm is just long enough to get 150 people. So it's clearly adapted to the purpose. Anyway, okay, next slide. All right, so in fact, Yes, we live in this social world which consists of 150 people that we kind of are meaningful relationships with, but they don't look like this. Our social world isn't a kind of homogenous thing. It's much more clumpy and patchy. And in that sense, is quite strikingly layered, in fact. Okay, next. You get a sense of this from these data. These are our Christmas card data. These are quite, the effect is quite robust here. We've got the same result in every single data set we've looked at. this is plotting the mean time since you last contacted them, which essentially is just a measure of an index of how often you contact them. So this is yesterday was the last time I saw them. This was 8 months ago. And this is our measure of emotional closeness, just on a simple 0 to 10 scale. 10, you love them dearly. 0, you're neutral. They're, you know, you don't hate them. It's just a sort of basic relationship. And you can see there's this nice negative relationship. The people you love most dearly, you see most often. The people you're sort of more neutral about, you see infrequently. This is in your 150, as it were. But if you look at that data, there's a sense, yes, please. Next, please. There's a sense of layers in there where there's some clustering going on. So next, please. We did a lot of very, very heavy cranking looking at these data to look for recurring patterns in the data. So we actually used the maths of fractals to do this. And this is our ethnographic database, and this is our Christmas card database. And the key to this is the position of this peak here. This is the fractal parameter. And its actual value is pretty much the same in both these data sets. And when you translate that back into what it means in the real world, it means there's a scaling ratio which is almost exactly 3 in both data sets. This was another analysis done by a bunch of anthropologists at, in the Northwest in the US on hunter-gatherer data, on that, one of the big hunter-gatherer databases. Looking at, and it's done in a slightly different way. This is a Horton order analysis, which is another way of doing fractal. We got physicists to do this for us, so they did it in the most complicated way they could. These guys had better statistical advice, if you like, and there's this much simpler technique. The scaling effect is produced, given to you by the slope relating these. So these are either, you can do it one of two ways, the frequency of groups in different sort of size clusters, as it were, or by their relative size, and either way it comes out. Same thing, the slope here. Well, they actually got a slope of 3.8, so a fraction under 4, but it's turned out that that's what you get if you anchor it at the individual. So they used 1, the individual, as the anchor for this, and this tends to pull the slope down. If you take the individual out, their data go very nice. It's actually 3.2 slope, so it's exactly the same as we get. So nice confirmation once you understand the statistical issue that they accidentally created here, and that was created by they had a particular conception of how the thing was working. But essentially, these are inclusive layerings of society, as it were. So families within, in effect, bands within communities and within wider regional groupings and so on. All right, next please. So what that means for you is something that looks a bit like this. This is your social world here. Here you are sitting at the center of what, in effect, are a series of circles of friendship that go out to 150 and then beyond that. We know from our data that there are at least 2 more layers out beyond that, one at 500, one at 1500. And these layers scale, and remember, they're inclusive, so the 15 here includes the 5. These layers scale in a ratio of about 3. So these are the numbers we use because they're the sort of nearest whole numbers, as it were. So there's somewhere around 5 intimate friends, 15 best friends, including the intimate friends, 50 good friends, 150 friends. And then you enter the acquaintances layer up to 500. This 1500 layer appears to be the number of people you can put names to faces for. It's a memory problem only. What's interesting, just to provide a little framework and to show you that science hasn't progressed in 2,350 years, Aristotle got that one right? He said, the number of good friends you can count on the fingers of one hand. And Plato got the next number out, 5,000, which incidentally, as you'll notice, is the limit of the number of friends you can have on Facebook. He said the ideal democracy size is, I think he said 5,300, but, you know, they didn't understand statistics, 300 BC, so we'll allow him a little statistical error there. But anyway, the key is this boundary here. This boundary seems to differentiate between individuals with whom you have a meaningful relationship from those with whom you have something that is a meaningful reciprocated relationship. It's a relationship of obligation and trust and reciprocity, as opposed to these layers out here where the relationship is much more one way. You know who these people are, they don't necessarily know who you are. So I guess the Queen sits here, no doubt the Vice Chancellor's in there for some of us, if you know him by sight, as it were. In other words, you'd recognise them when they walk down the street. But if you wandered up to them and slapped them on the back and said, why don't you come and have a drink? You'd probably get arrested if it was the Queen, wouldn't you? By the man in a very large suit with a big bulge under his armpit. Whereas these people in here, you have a reciprocated relationship with, you would go back, they would know where you stand in their world, and they would say, oh yes, let's go and have a drink, I haven't seen you for ages. So that's what your social world really looks like. These layers are a function both of the frequency with which you contact people and of the emotional intensity of the relationship. So as you go out, the frequency of contact is dropping. This is really defined by people whom you see about once a year or so, whereas these are people you see almost every week, probably. But the emotional intensity is also declining as you go out. These are very intimate relationships. These are much, much less so. And that becomes important because people drift in and out of these layers as a function of how much time you spend with them. Okay, next, please. The key, however, and this actually surprised us, is that your network of 150 actually consists of two separate sub-networks, a family network and a friendship network, and these have completely different dynamics. In our data set of European women, which is a very large data set of individual networks, on average, 50% of the people listed are family. And what's interesting is people who come from very, remember these are European, they're actually Belgian and UK women, so that we're not talking about hunter-gatherers or traditional societies here. People who come from large extended families list fewer friends. They have fewer friends. It really is as though there is a limit at about 150. It varies a little bit from one individual to another. There's this cognitive limit. You've got 150 slots. You fill them preferentially with family members. If you've got a lot of family members, you just don't have many slots left over for unrelated friends. And incidentally, we treat affines, in-laws, as though they were genetic relatives. Data from these data, in fact, showing that. But I just want to illustrate here the difference in the dynamics between kinship networks. So what this is we did an 18-month study of people going away to university, basically, because they were going to move away from home, to see what happened to their relationships with their original cohort of friends back home in the last 6 months of school. And this is sort of what the average emotional closeness, their ratings of the average emotional closeness to either members of their family, their extended family, including in-laws, or to their proper friends, as it were, not in the Facebook sense of friends, but true friends. And you can see that over time, and most of these people are going away from home, so they're meeting new people, they're not seeing their old friends. But remember, this is, in the case of friends, this is their original cohort of friends back here that these data reflect. Kinship is very stable. Even though you're not seeing them, your emotional closeness to them remains unchanged. And in fact, it even goes up. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's amazing. The more cynical parents might observe that this is a consequence of pleas coming through at a weekend or late in the week, saying, if I come home this weekend, can I bring my washing with me for you to do? Because I really love you. But there is a sense in which kinship, nonetheless, even if this isn't a real increase. It's clearly not a very big war. There is a sense in which kinship is robust to these destabilizing effects. Right? We can abuse kin, and they still come and help us out. It's not what I'm recommending, but those relationships are incredibly robust, whereas friendships, in contrast, are incredibly fragile. The moment you stop seeing somebody, the quality of the friendship changes, and they start to bump down through the layers. Next, please. And this just shows what happens, in a sense, to these. This is mean emotional closeness, or the change in emotional closeness from over, I think it was the first 9 months of the study, to that same group of friends at the start. And this is only friends, right, not family, as a function of whether you spent, or the subject spent, less time contacting them at month 9 than they had at month 0, about the same or more. And it's split by males and females. So these are the blokes here, these are the girls in green. And you'll see that how dramatic this effect is. It's a massive drop if you spend less time interacting with them. That's all you're doing. But for girls, at least, if you increase the rate of contact when you've moved away from home and you aren't seeing them so often, if you phone them up and these kind of things, this includes phone call contacts, if you go back and see them often, it holds the relationship up. It stops it decaying so rapidly. You will notice that apparently talking to your friends has a negative effect on boys' relationships, if anything. However, there's an even more extraordinary result here. So next, please. This is the other half of the question we ask them. So not only we ask them, when did you last contact them by phone or face-to-face or what have you, but also, have you done stuff with them? Have you been partying with them? Have you been on holiday with them? Have you helped them move house or gone shopping with them or what have you? There's a list of things they checked off. So this is the same data, but now for activity score. So this is a decrease in doing stuff together. We did about the same amount together then and now, and this is an increase. And just look at this. Okay, next, please. All right, it's the complete opposite. All right, for what allows girls' relationships to survive separation is talking together. What allows boys' relationships to survive is banging their heads together. All right, so you've got to go home and do stuff, whatever boys do. And there's an extraordinary sex difference here. So this is my claim that these evidence support the urban myth that girls spend an hour on the phone at a time, right? Because the technology, and this is true of Facebook, because they're much bigger users of Facebook and other social networking sites than boys. Two-thirds of Facebook time is by girls. The technology in both these cases, Facebook and telephone, is perfectly designed for how they manage their social world. But it's absolutely useless for boys, because the only reason for making a phone call is to say, meet you later. So I maintain this explains why boys' phone calls only last 7.3 seconds on average, because all you've got to say is, see you down the pub. That's the end of the conversation. You've got to go and do stuff, bang heads together, to establish a relationship. And the cartoon version of that, just to sort of hammer the point home, is think about what relationships are like when you're about 8. Right? Now, for girls, these are very intense, and girls' relationships, in contrast to boys, girls' relationships, even as adults, are very much more intense. You often find a best girlfriend, as it were, that is a very, very strong relationship, and it's not a romantic relationship in any sense, but it has many of the signatures of that. There's constant contact, and they spend a lot of time talking to each other. So, you know, when you were 8, if Penelope didn't invite you to her party, this is the end of an era. You know, the universe had finally come to an end, and it's great crisis and tears and whatnot. Now, a relationship for boys is standing on opposite sides of the road, kicking a football backwards and forwards. And I maintain that it actually doesn't matter for boys whether it's a little boy kicking the football back or the wall. As long as the football comes back to you, that's a relationship. So you've got this extraordinary difference between the two sexes in the nature of close same-sex kind of friendships, as it were, that they're very intense with girls and therefore very limited in number. They're much more kind of loose and casual for boys and tend to involve more numbers. And if you look at Facebook profile pictures, that's exactly what you see. We've just done an analysis of 120,000 Facebook profile pictures, And the most, aside from sort of pictures of you and your mum or you and your baby, your motorbike in the case of boys apparently, or just yourself, if you have more than one person in the photograph who's of the same generation of you, it's two for girls typically, it's about four for boys. And there's this sense that boys' relationships are much more casual and they can pick them up and drop them. They're not quite so strong and meaningful. This sort of comes out very nicely out of these kind of data. Okay, next please. There's another case. I mean, in a sense, what that was really reinforcing was the fact that there's a time-cost relationship. So you have to invest very heavily in them in terms of time. And something like 60% of our total social time is devoted to our 15 closest friends, and a relatively small proportion distributed among the other 135. But there's one nice example of how costly relationships can be. So we were looking at the inner core five. This is a very big sample, about nearly 550 people. So this is the distribution of number of intimate friends you have. In the standard, this is the median value. These are the 50% ranges, and these are the extremes, as it were, up here. So they're bunched very nicely around five. But we'd also asked these people, were you in a relationship or not? So this was an active relationship. So this is the people who said no. Next, please. These are the people who said yes. Right? They only have four on average, and that's a whacking great statistically significant difference. And if you reflect on it for a moment, well, first of all, what this is telling you is that romance is costly. You sacrifice a friend. But if you think about it, actually you've sacrificed two friends because you never form a romantic relationship with somebody who's already in your inner five. Well, it's very, very rare. Normally they come in from way outside, sometimes even outside your 150, of course. So for that person to come into your inner five and to end up with four means you've had to drop two close friends, sacrifice them. And if you look at what people do, now this is bad news. If you did it for both friends, if you drop two friends, that's all you have, since half your five are made up of friends and half family, two and a half friends, two and a half family. If you drop two friends, you've got no shoulders to cry on, because your mum's just going to say, get a grip. On the other hand, family are very important. They support you. You know, if there's anybody going to come to your rescue, it's going to be family when the chips are really down. So you don't want to lose them either. And what it turns out people do is they sacrifice one friend and one member of the family. And so they drop down into the lower level. But what's very cunning about that, if you think back to what I just mentioned a little earlier, family relationships are much more resilient. So they're trading off here, seems to be happening, they're trading off the fact that they really sacrifice a friend who isn't going to be a friend for much longer, but they're sort of, in order to keep one friend, one shoulder to cry on, they're sacrificing a family member in the knowledge that the damage to that relationship won't be so bad. That relationship will carry on reasonably well through time. Extraordinary. That, you know, romance is expensive. but this is clearly a reflection of how time costly a romantic relationship is. Your whole focus and your attention and what you do is all focused on this one person. You're spending disproportionately more time with them than you would normally do with just an ordinary friend. Okay, next please. And it's just a reminder of how important networks are. These are Nick Christakis's data from the Framingham Heart Study in New England, in the US, where they have an entire community that's been followed over several generations now, I think. But this is the distribution of happiness against, so they were rating themselves as being happy or unhappy, and people who rated themselves as happy are in yellow, and people who rated themselves as unhappy in blue, plotted onto the network of friendships that they also collected data on. You can see that blues cluster together and yellows cluster together. So the secret in life, clearly, if you want to be happy, is find happy friends, I guess. But next, please. And this just reinforces that numbers are critical here. I think this is just the easiest one to listen to. This is the probability that you'll be happy in future as a function of the number of happy friends you have now. So as you, the number of happy friends increases, so you become happier, up to about three. And then after that, it really doesn't make any difference. It levels off. So my recommendation to you is that the secret of nirvana is to find three happy people and become friends with them, and your life is made. Okay, thanks. And just to reinforce, again, actually, this sense that your choice of friends is very important, and this may be an explanation for the previous data, that the reason you get happy and unhappy people clustering together is like goes with like. There's a strong tendency, it's what's become known as the birds of a feather model of friendship. People who share similar interests are more likely to be friends. So these are measures of emotional closeness and a sort of notional altruism. We actually had several of them in there. Would you give them 5,000? Would you donate a kidney if pushed, if asked? As a function of the number of shared traits you had, and they had a long list of traits, and they were doing this for selected individual members of their various circles from family and friends, and these are just average. And you can see that basically if you share at least three major traits in common, it starts to really make a difference. And the quality of the friendship increases as a function of how many more traits. And it's a linear increase as well. These are substitutable. And they seem to be a set of six key things. That sharing the same language, same educational background, coming from the same location, having the same hobbies and interests, having the same worldview, let's say political views or religion, and sharing the same sense of humor. And sharing the same sense of humor seems to be the top dog in this. That's the strongest effect. But on the whole, these are substitutable. So it doesn't matter which, let's say, four of those six traits you use, you can get a relationship of that strength. Okay, next please. One of the things struck by this, one of the things we did was to go out and run a sample where we took a bunch of, we had people rate, I think it was 100 jokes from 1,000 best joke book. And we found 18 jokes, I think it was, where people radically disagreed. Some thought they were funny, very funny, some thought they were terrible. Then we gave a bunch of people these jokes and said, rate them for whether you think they're funny or not. And then we took those data and created a humor profile for them, right? Which essentially, described their sense of humor in some ways. Then 2 weeks later, we emailed them back and said, listen, we've got this person who you might be interested in getting to meet, and this is their humor profile. And what we didn't tell them, because we're doing it as psychologists, not as economists who hate doing this kind of thing, what we didn't tell them was it was their humor profile we were sending back. But we had changed it so that it was slightly different. And at one extreme, they only shared 2 out of the 18 jokes in common. At the other extreme, they shared 16, and these were in the middle. And you can see the more jokes you share in common, the more similar your humor profile is, the more likely they were to say, yes, actually, this might be somebody I'd be interested in meeting, perhaps. So humor is very important. The other thing about social networks, and particularly social networks in small-scale societies, and therefore face-to-face communities, is the policeman effect. Everybody's watching you. Your business is everybody's business. And this is a lovely demonstration of this effect. So this was done in the staff coffee room in the psychology department at Newcastle University a couple of years ago. And the problem they'd had, heads of department, heads of college may take note, was that people weren't putting money in the tin for the tea and the coffee they had. So there's a little tin by the kettle and stuff and a notice over the top saying, please put in 10p for every cup of tea you have to cover the cost of milk and stuff. And they just weren't getting much money in. So they had the idea of seeing whether the sense of being watched made any difference. So over a period of 10 weeks, they either put a bunch of flowers, a picture of flowers above the little notice which said, please put your money in the tin, or, next please, they put some eyes. And then they recorded each week how much money was put in the tin. Next please. Glaringly obvious, right? some wag has put this in our kitchen in the Institute above a notice which says, please wash up after you. pair of vicious eyes peering at you. The police in Nottingham were so impressed by these data, and Nottingham had a very, very high sort of weekend crime rate, street crime rate. The police in Nottingham put up eyes all over the place in the centre of the city with "we're watching you" underneath. And they reckon it reduced casual crime, street crime, by 17%. It's amazing. It works. But it's a sense of being watched, that a network or community, a small-scale community, everybody's, you know, making sure people aren't stepping out of line. Okay, next, please. So the question is, crikey, how are we doing? We must be sort of... Okay, I'll try and keep it short because we started late, but I'm conscious that your drinks are awaiting you at some point. How do we actually create these relationships? Well, if we go back to what monkeys and apes do, and after all, this is where all this story started with monkeys and apes, it seems to work as a sort of two-stage process or a two-process mechanism. One is they do a lot of this grooming stuff, which is very intense. It's very one-to-one. In fact, we still do it. We kind of call it cuddling and petting and patting, because what it's doing is, and it is very intimate still with us, obviously, and it is with them. But what this does is it releases endorphins, which create this sort of slight sense of opiate high and make you feel very relaxed and trusting with the people you're doing it with. And then that state, as it were, that sort of psychopharmacological internal state, allows you to create a cognitive relationship of trust and so on, which is where the cognitive component comes in. So it's two completely separate things. There's a time-based component built around endorphins and this cognitive component. I'll just show you a little bit of data about both just to share how that works with humans. So next, please. So this is what the cognitive component is all about. It's about so-called mentalizing or mind reading, the ability to understand what other people are thinking, to see their perspective, so you can kind of negotiate a common trajectory of a relationship through time. Traditionally, and this really came out of philosophy of mind in the 60s, so these were known as the levels of intentionality. They form a natural reflexive hierarchy. Jack here is in first order intentionality. He has a belief about the world. Jill is in second order. She believes that Jack believes that something's the case. And Jack now is in third order. He believes that Jill believes that Jack believes that something's the case. This is theory of mind proper, so-called, which developmental psychologists have spent the last couple of decades really tearing apart. But children aged 5 acquire this. And it turns out that adults, the kind of average level of intentionality that adults can cope with is 5th order. So it's sort of 2 more orders up here. And it looks a bit like that there. So the intentional states, the mind states are underlined here. It's these words that, you know, like believe, suppose, imagine, and the like, intend. Next, please. So we gave a bunch of these sort of tasks to people to rate their sort of level of performance, and you get something that looks a bit like this. So this is a rather extreme version where we were trying tasks which had 9 levels of intentionality in them. Probably the tails are a bit artifactual, but the nice thing here is here's this nice peak. This is the point, the highest point at which they could cope, as it were, with these and get the answers correct for the mental states of, you know, sort of yourself plus 4 other people. That gives you 5th order intentionality. And you get this nice peak at that point with sort of falling away here. Then what we did with these people is we said, okay, tell us how many friends you have in that 15 circle. So that's defined in terms of the number of people you see on a fairly regular basis, about once a month at least. So it's a time-based measure, nothing to do with the intensity of the relationship. Next, please. When you plot one against the other, you get this nice correlation. Very scattered, but statistically it's very solid. And, you know, we've replicated this 3 times with 3 different data sets now, so it's quite robust. The more friends you have, the better you are at these tasks, the more friends you have in this layer, this second layer, essentially, of relationships. We know what the cause of some of that scatter is. Part of it's a gender difference. Girls are better than boys on these kind of mentalizing tasks, and as a result, they have more friends in any given layer. Some of it's personality differences, you know, and that's just producing the scatter. Okay, but there's an interesting question here. You know, essentially what you're looking at here is a behavioral outcome, some software, a cognitive capacity in the brain, and that leads us to wonder whether there's a three-way correlation here, and that there should be some hardware in the equation. So you've got the hardware, the software, and the behavioral outcome. So it set us off into doing some neuroimaging studies. Next, please. And sure enough, the number of friends you have and your intentional competences turn up in the same key parts of the brain, and particularly the key parts of the brain that are used well understood to be involved in theory of mind. So this is looking at higher order, and it's looking at the differences between individuals. Some people are only scoring at fifth order, some at fourth order, some at fifth order. We didn't actually take them past fifth order, because we wanted them to be within the natural range, as it were. But this is a very fine-grained voxel-based morphometry analysis. What it's essentially showing is that in addition to the temporal lobe locations, you get a very strong signal up in the orbital frontal cortex up here. That's a quantitative effect of the size of the neural bundle that's active when you're doing these mentalizing tasks, and your competences, and as a three-way correlation, the number of friends you have. And then we did a very gross stereological analysis, just looking at the size of two major chunks of the, well, actually, we split it up into all these chunks, but it turned out this is the prefrontal cortex. The critical bit is this bit down here, and hemisphere doesn't matter, and whether it's inside or outside doesn't matter. It's the orbital frontal cortex that's critical. The size of that correlates both with your mentalizing competences and with the number of friends you have. These are very robust effects. They've been replicated three times now, once more by us in a later study, once by some people down in London. And they've been replicated here in macaques, the same effect by the group over in psychology, Matt Rushworth's group. Okay, so we have a very strong relationship. I mean, there's interesting questions you can ask about developmental cause and effect. I mean, can you, you know, is this effect a consequence of your socialization? So if you have lots of social experiences in the sandpit when you're young, do you develop more cognitive skills, more of these mentalizing skills, and are able to handle more relationships as a result, or are they genetically fixed? We simply don't know. There's evidence certainly to support the possibility of developmental effects of that kind. So that's perfectly plausible. What we do know is that this is a causal sequence, that it's the size of this affects your mentalizing competences, and it's your mentalizing competences that determine the number of friends you have. That is the causal order in which it happens. And what we also know from general brain developmental stuff is it becomes locked finally at about the age of early 20s sometime. And so I'm afraid you're all done for. There's no way you can increase the number, even if these developmental effects are quite important. As you're growing up, by the time you hit the early mid-20s, that's it. You'll never have any more friends. It's downhill all the way to the bath chair, I'm afraid. Okay, next please. So this is the other side of the story. This is the time component. If you look at the amount of social time that individual species of monkeys spend, the proportion of their day devoted to social time, this grooming activity, and plotted against group size, these are the averages for individual species of monkeys and apes. You get this very quite robust linear relationship between the two, but it tails off at a certain point with an upper limit at about 20% of total data. So these very social species are spending a fifth of their day doing this kind of stuff, huge investment, and they tend to be the ones that live in relatively large groups. Next, please. This is why it works. This is this diagram here. A very nice set of experimental results on monkeys showing that grooming releases endorphins. And when you have an endorphin release, you kind of lose an interest in having more social relationships for a little bit. So it's like an inoculation, as it were, that keeps you on a high. Not to avoid relationships, but that you need to keep topping it up in some sense. So what this is a bunch of monkeys who are given a tiny, tiny subclinical dose of morphine, so small you wouldn't be able to detect it in the blood. And it's looking at a measure of their interest in social interaction. So this is the number of grooming partners they have. You can look at it in a number of different ways. And it's way down compared with the control animals that were given a saline injection, just salt water, basically. And the nice thing about this is they did the experiment the other way round, and they gave another bunch of monkeys a opiate blocker, naltrexone, which locks onto the same receptor sites, but is neutral in its effect. So opiates can't, brain's opiates can't get into the site and give you this buzz. And by comparison with the saline controls, these animals can't get enough grooming. They're just constantly going around trying to request grooming all the time. So this is essentially why drug addicts lose an interest in the social world, because the opiates, the artificial opiates they're taking, are replacing the opiates you would normally give each other in sort of everyday social events. Okay, next please. So back to the question of what we should do in this context, and if you plug our group sizes of 150 in here, what we ought to do is spend about 45% or thereabouts of our total daytime hugging and cuddling, to be blunt. But there's clearly, monkeys have this upper limit here. So the question is, what do we actually do? Folk wisdom perhaps suggests to you, I don't know what undergraduates do these days, but folk wisdom suggests that most of us don't spend so much of our time engaged in hugging and cuddling. Partly because some of us have to work in the real world and earn our living, and that's very expensive. So the question is, what do humans naturally do? Next, please. This is the mean for 7 time budget studies from all around the world. So it's everything from a diary study done in Dundee to hill farmers in Nepal, Maasai pastoralists in East Africa, so on, a whole range of different economists and cultures. This is the average amount of time devoted to social interaction in the day for these. So each of these, remember, is the average for a species, so that's our average. It's bang on 20. So it looks like we use the same amount of social time, but somehow use it more efficiently to kind of bring it up to, in some way, the effectiveness of spending twice as much time in social interaction. So the question is, how do we do that? Next, please. One obvious way is language, in a sense. And language gives us lots of sort of useful benefits compared with grooming, which I won't bother to go into. They're fairly obvious. I mean, not least the fact you can, in effect, groom with several individuals at a time. But what you're not getting, next please, is the buzz that endorphins give you. As far as we know, just talking to somebody doesn't give you the same buzz that you get from physical grooming in the primate world, and indeed which we get with very intimate relationships. And I don't mean just romantic relationships, I mean the way you touch your best friend, as it were, and your parents and these kind of things. These are producing those same endorphin highs. So what have we done? And I think this is the answer. These are the predicted grooming times for all the major fossil hominid populations. So each of these is one population, basically, the average. And it's taking cranial volumes and calculating neocortex size from that, and then using that to calculate group size, and then using group size to calculate required grooming time. Here's the upper limit for great apes at 20%, primates in general at 20%. Here are the Australopithecines, jobbing great apes, basically. They're doing nothing unusual. And then it starts to take off, and it gets up to modern humans up here. So this is essentially the bonding gap. And the way we've filled it, next please, I think is thus. Starts with this stuff, builds into music and singing and dancing, performance of music as opposed to sitting politely listening, and then finally gets to essentially the rituals of religion. And I think, next please, they came in this order, quite literally. next please. Don't worry. There's an actual sequence there in which we start with laughter, and then that builds into music and eventually builds into language, because you need language for religion. But what's interesting about those three is they share a lot of properties in common. Synchrony, segmentation, whole bunch of physical characteristics, and they're all very good releases of endorphins. So here's some evidence to just show that. This is looking at the effect of music. This is looking at the effect of laughter. The design, all these studies is the same. We're using a pain threshold measure as a measure of endorphin production, because if you've got all these endorphins coming up, what the endorphins are as part of the pain control system, it lifts your pain threshold. So if you've had lots of endorphins produced, your pain threshold should be higher. So we give these poor folk a pain threshold test. We allow them to do an activity of some form, and then we retest their pain threshold and see if there's a change across that. Here, they're either doing a musical activity, or they're watching a video, or just passively listening to music. So this is actually, this is an Anglican prayer meeting, and this is a charismatic service. So here there's lots of singing and upper body movements, and here they're just sitting passively in their pews, listening to readings and praying and so on. This is a drumming circle. This is the staff in, I think it was the HMV store in Liverpool. So they're listening to music all day. It's permanently on. These were our MSc students watching a video of an American university video on the evils of drugs and drug taking. I point out to this huge difference of charismatics. It's no wonder charismatics, Christian groups always look so happy. They got endorphins flooding around like fury. Again, drumming here, and clearly listening to music isn't what's important. What's important is you've got to be physically engaged. And as it happens, laughter, the reason laughter works is precisely that it's very exhausting for the body. So this constant sort of filling and emptying of the lungs, and these long exhalations, because the big difference between our laughter and great ape laughter, and specifically chimpanzee laughter, is their form of laughter is inhalation, exhalation, ha, ha, ha. It's a play vocalization for them, but it's absolutely identical. In humans, what we do is we just have a long series of exhalations, ha, 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 ha. Until you run out of breath. And that's very stressful for the chest and the upper body, and very, very tiring. And it's that seems to give you this endorphin surge, because all these guys here are watching comedy videos, or they're watching boring neutral videos as the control. So most of these were watching things like golfing instruction videos. And these people were watching, you know, sort of Mr. Bean, what have you. I think this lot watched Michael McIntyre videos, performance videos. The exception was this lot, which I really like, because we did it at the Edinburgh Fringe. So for those of you who know, this is the Oxford Imps performing. And these are the members of the crowd, in effect, watching the Oxford Imps performing. This is actually a combination of two drama groups performing from Oxford. At the Edinburgh Fringe in 2008, I think it was. But you can see the huge difference. Apparently watching drama doesn't have quite the same lift as watching stand-up comedy live. So it works really nicely. So here's evidence that laughter really produces the endorphin surges. Now, let me show you the effect of that. Next, please. We did exactly the same study, but this time, these are pilot data. We're still in the process of trying to replicate this, but this is our first effort at this, and it looked very encouraging. What we did was we took people in pairs. They either watched a video, comedy video or a golfing video, in with a friend or with somebody who was not a friend, and they were always doing it in groups of four, so there'd be two pairs. Then we would give all the money for attending, £5, to one of member of the pair, and so you can split it with the other member of the pair however you like. And these are the results. So these people came with friends. These ones watched the golfing video, these watched the comedy video and therefore laughed a lot, and they split it about 50-50. So the person who was given the money shared it fairly equally. These people did the task with a complete stranger. They watched the neutral video, and look, they only gave about 70p to the other person. They kept £4.30. This is what happens when you laugh with a stranger. Suddenly you treat them as a friend. And you think, oh, that's what laughter's all about. It's creating this wider community. Next, please. So the question is, if it's just about physical activity, why don't you just go down the gym and do it, right? Well, the answer is mostly, you know, you put earphones on and you don't talk to people. That's bad news. And it occurred to us that the real issue here is doing this as a group. And that the whole, what makes, you know, laughter only happens, only the mad laugh on their own, remember. What's important about laughter or any of these other activities is you do it as a synchronized group. So we had the idea of using rowing for this purpose. So next, please. This was done on the 2008 boat cruise, right? On the Blue and Isis boats. Exactly the same format, essentially, but we used every morning workout sessions as the testing. The nice thing about the erg machines is they can either do it on their own or you can link them up into virtual boats. So I think altogether there were 12 of them out of the 16 that did it for us. They either did it on their own or in a virtual boat, and then they repeated it a week later, so we got a repeat sample. Here's zero is no change in pain threshold before to after doing their normal 5 o'clock in the morning workout on the machines, whatever they do. Here's the level when they're doing it on their own, but just look what happens when they're doing it as a virtual boat and they're working in absolute synchrony with each other. Now, this is not a power output problem, because we let them do the first week and we said, okay, you're rowing at that rate, now row at that rate at that power output right the way through. And of course, they can read the power output off here and they know what they're doing. They're, you know, top class rowers, as it were. But we can also measure to see that they're not actually exceeding them. So in fact, the power output for each person is absolutely identical in these two conditions, but the endorphin surge they're getting from doing it in synchrony, it's a pure synchrony of the activity that's important, is somehow ramping it up and producing a massive effect. What we think this is exactly what Durkheim referred to as effervescence, that sense of uplift you get from doing these communal activities, dancing and so on. Okay, so I think this is the end. So next slide, please. Yes, thank you very much.